I'm Bonnie Bowie, for those of you that came in late. Well, I'm not going to pretend to have all the answers, and I always learn so much from others as I'm, you know, I teach mostly in the graduate program at Seattle University, so I get older students, and I always learn so much from them. And I typically need to stand, I don't know why, while I talk, so I probably do that some of the time. Just a recap for those of you that weren't here the last couple of days, we started out, this is sort of my model, with Outreach Ministries in the middle, and we started out doing a walkabout in the neighborhood, a windshield survey where we were looking at, you know, who are our neighbors, and I was talking about how our neighborhood for Cross of Christ has really changed, and I was talking to our outreach person, and we were talking about brainstorming this fall about, you know, reconnecting with our own neighborhood, and I thought, what a wonderful segue for the Bible study this morning in terms of connecting with your neighbors and building those relationships. So we talked about methods for doing that on Monday, or maybe not your immediate neighborhood, but maybe you're doing outreach in another neighborhood you know, really familiarizing yourself with that neighborhood and how to define that community. Although sometimes the outreach is around a common issue. For example, homelessness. We have congregations for the homeless on the east side of Lake Washington in Seattle, and so we have a big broad area where we're coming together as a community around a common issue. So it's not always a geographic area. And then we talked yesterday about looking at our own congregational resources and different ways of tallying those up sort of and looking at where our strengths are and where maybe what we're doing now in outreach ministry, and maybe we talked about, you know, some of the old dogs that maybe we need to let go or keep, depending upon. Sometimes we have people that are very vested in small ministries, and maybe that's okay because it keeps them very connected to the church. But looking at where we're spending our energies and resources, and can we, and trying to identify what do we have a passion for, where do we want to focus, and then begin to build in that area or in other areas. You know, business terminology, what is it, you know, where you have your areas of focus. We're using that at Seattle U now, your kind of signature areas. And so I hate to bring in too much business terminology to church stuff, but I think sometimes it is good to look at what are the places where we really have the passion, the desire, and the energy, because as you know, this takes a lot of energy. And so
the term you're talking about, is that core competencies by any chance?
Core competencies?
Core competencies, because that was one of the business terms that Boeing went through to ask from a business standpoint, where are our core competencies, so they would know which ones to say, we're going to outsource these because this isn't a core competency.
To me, competency is more, you know, you've mastered that skill. If
right,
you're competent
at
something.
The way that it was used is that this is a resource. You know, the competency is a resource.
Yeah.
From a company standpoint, the competency is the people that you've brought in.
Yeah.
And so that's how it was actually used.
You have the talent and
the
skills.
Yeah, they saw that as a resource, and they say, well, what is the core resource that we have in the competency of our people? So
yeah, I agree.
That's kind of that might, you know, using that outside of, you know, that type of concept to resources within the church. What are the core skills, if you will?
Yeah, what are we good at?
That you bring to bear as a resource.
Yeah, what are we good at? I think definitely you need to look at that, because if you're asked, you know, all of these are run, of course, with volunteer hours, and so you don't want to launch out. And it sounds like maybe your pastor you know, was very passionate about the homeless issue but didn't have everybody else with him or her. I don't know. I'm looking at
that's my understanding.
Yeah, so that, yeah. sometimes that happens, mm-hmm. you know, you forget you need to bring everyone along with you, yeah.
Yeah.
And not just within the congregation, but the community, yeah. which I think we're going to talk about Seattle Mennonite Church, which is doing an incredible job of doing that. So today we're going to talk about partnerships and identifying those. And I was hoping to brainstorm a little bit, maybe we can just do it as a big group a little bit later on about how do you identify those partnerships. But ideally, we began this work in the assessment phase as we really started looking at the neighborhood and who was there, who was already doing that, you know, work or similar work, or working with the same population perhaps that we want to work with. And so going in and again, if you haven't in the initial assessment phase talked with some of those potential agency partners to talk with them about, what are their needs. Particularly if you're a smaller congregation, and you don't want to be the lead, you can always fill in another area for an agency about what can we do to assist you. And certainly our congregation has done that with HopeLink, which is in our neighborhood. Yeah.
So when you say assess our neighbors, you're talking about agencies and businesses.
As well as the people who live there. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah. And that's what we talked about Monday. So. Identifying what kind of agencies there are that you could potentially partner with. Mm-hmm. And so, maybe community mental health, other like Catholic services, mm-hmm. Or whatever's in your neighborhood. And maybe they're not right in the immediate neighborhood, but close enough that you're looking at serving the same populations. Mm-hmm. There's that overlap. I think sometimes, a lot of times for me, I those partnerships evolve over time, and they change over time. It's a kind of a dynamic system. But one thing I think that we don't often think about, we are a faith community as we reach out and do this work, is that our mission statements don't have to be identical, but I think they do have to dovetail. They do need to be in harmony. So we're, and that doesn't mean you can't partner with government agencies such as public health. I think that's actually a pretty good fit. Oh, hi, come on in. But what's been so gratifying about our university, which is of course a Catholic university partnering with the Seattle Mennonite Church, is that we have so much in common in terms of our foundation. It's just a great fit. And do you know Melanie Neufeld? If you know, you're the pastor there.
Yes,
Melanie,
yes,
and John. Yeah. I mean, we meet and we just, it's just really fun because stuff comes up and we're like, oh my gosh, it's like the Holy Spirit has just stepped in here. And we, together as we, it's like we can't believe sometimes how things have come together, and so it is very gratifying to have that common ground, although it's certainly, we have other agencies at the table that are not faith-based organizations, but at least we have some common, our mission is to reach out to the have-nots, so to speak. Were you going to say something?
No,
oh, okay. So having a shared purpose, and then looking at those strengths that build on each other. So, as you build your team, as you start identifying what you're doing, you're going to want to look for somebody who has the strength, the skills that, will augment what you're doing. And I feel very strongly that the leadership of these organizations really need to agree to the partnership. So if you embark upon this as a church, I think, it needs to, our ministry outreach committee will seek out partnerships and so forth. And if it's with other churches, we don't have a formal way of our congregation looking at that. But if it's another organization, I think it's really nice to know and to let the congregation know, let the council know and say, this is what we're thinking of doing. We're going to have this partnership. And this is what we're expecting, our church to do. And this is what they're going to do. To have the council very much aware of that and then bring it to the congregation, perhaps not for a vote, but certainly to keep everyone informed so they're not surprised. I remember years ago, I was very aware of this, that we had, before HopeLink built their lovely facility on the east side, which is real close to our church, and they have a drop-in clinic there. They were running a drop-in clinic on Saturdays in our Sunday school rooms because we weren't using them. So it was a perfect place to have it. And after they did that for about a year, and some of our members were involved in that, and at the end of the year, when they finished their facility, they came to our services to formally thank the congregation. And what was amazing to me, because it was in newsletters and so forth, here and there, and I remember reading about it, and I didn't volunteer at the time, I had two little kids, but many people were quite surprised that we were using our space that way. And that surprised me. I'm a person that tends to read, you know, even if I'm not involved in it, I listen and I go to stuff and I'm kind of involved. But and we talked last night about how you have to say things about 10 times over and over, and just when you think that you've said it so much, people must be sick of it, someone will say, oh, I didn't know that. So so really communicating these partnerships so that you can get the support you need, but also so we don't take people by surprise and they're like, what do you mean we're in partnership with the public health department? That's kind of a misfit. Come on. You know, that's not a faith-based community.
Bonnie, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You usually get letters of agreement with, especially a public agency, I would imagine that they would want a contract or a letter of agreement.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about
okay.
that. But not always. I mean, sometimes yes, but not always. I break bread together. But yeah, remind me if I don't talk about that enough. I think sometimes a formal contract is definitely warranted, and particularly if it's outside of the faith-based community. But sometimes an informal agreement or meeting minutes. I use meeting minutes. And so I'll send them back to people and say, this is what my recollection is that we talked about and what we've agreed to do. Is this what you remember? And then, you know, so I've made them very public. And then they have a chance to comment. And then that's our informal, formal agreement. Mm-hmm. So as you come to the table and start talking, you know, if at all possible, of course, this never happens, I think, in real life. I mean, sometimes we get going on things, and then we invite other people in as we go, or we get invited in when something's already up and going, and sometimes that works just fine. But if possible, it's kind of nice to have people involved at the beginning and in that planning stage, and that's what we're doing at the with the Lake City Project. It's very nice to have a facilitator who can, and that's their job, is to be sure that various people are talking, are having the chance to talk, are having input into how this process will go. I mentioned Melanie Neufeld, who is the pastor, one of the pastors, she's outreach pastor with her husband, they job share at the Seattle Mennonite Church, and she is just very good at that. And so she takes on that role, and I am really happy to have her do that role so that I can sit back and listen and help her to draw people out that we're talking to.
And you talked a little bit about the circumstance, because appointing a facilitator seems a little formal, and that there might be certain circumstances in which you want to do that and certain that you wouldn't. What sort of circumstances would you go to an outside resource to bring in a facilitator?
Oh. Well, if you're lucky enough to have somebody that's, you know, that you think is a good facilitator, I would just, and I would just say that up front to the group, we'd like to, you know, to have so-and-so be the, you know, Lee's going to be our facilitator to keep the meeting going and to make sure that everyone is heard.
So you do that even within just a group meeting, that, say like you're on a team and you meet once a month and you have a separate facilitator? Or would you...
Are you
saying that the facilitator would be and say you're going to discuss the issue among the in the congregation?
I'm just talking about an outside facilitator.
It doesn't have to be an outside facilitator. I mean, there are people who are trained in that, who are, you know, and it's really kind of a luxury to have someone like that. If it's a very friendly group, you could rotate the role.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Let me back up.
Okay.
One thing I do that I don't have on these slides is that I really like when a group is coming together at the meeting to agree on how we're going to, you know, that we're how we're going to meet. You know, you guys have heard of probably, what do they call them? Because of meeting rules or whatever, not rules, but
mutual contract.
Yeah, sort of an agreement about how we're going to work together as a group. So I like to spell that out and say, we agree to meet at least once a month to be honest with each other, to, you know, if we have any concerns, to bring them forward. And then if it was me, I would say, I find it extremely helpful to appoint one person to be the facilitator. And if you all want, if we want, we can rotate that position. It's somebody who will keep the meeting going, will make sure that all are heard, that will say, you know, well, Janice, you've, you know, that's really great, but in terms of the, you know, tactfully say, in terms of the, you know, kind of monopolizing the meeting, but in a nice way say, let's make sure that so-and-so is heard. But somebody like that, because, you know, and then I love having Melanie do this because I'm able to participate in the meeting, which is kind of a luxury for me. So, and she's very good at it. And it's what's kind of interesting in this instance is at Lake City is that she has just stepped up to that role. And I'm like, boy, this is great. So we've actually never discussed with the group in this instance, but everyone seems very happy with it. She's so inclusive. She does not, she doesn't voice an opinion so much. She says, well, this is the consensus that I'm hearing from the group to wrap it up. And she just does a fabulous job. So it's just sort of naturally evolved. And then I'm taking a lot of notes on my little, you know, laptop as I'm there. And as I said, so that's just naturally evolved. And that's okay, too. But I think it's good. You know, when I was on council, I really pushed that to say, let's have some working agreements that we will, what we discuss is confidential when we leave the room. We may disagree, but we're going out as a united front. And those were, so some of the things that I felt were very important. So as the chair, I didn't realize you were co-chairing that project. Boy, no wonder when you said that in the introduction.
Well, and the reason I asked that question is because trying to get the thing in context to, and I'm sure that other people, well, where does this context fit into what I'm doing? And the reason I zeroed in on the word facilitator is because we had identified the need for a facilitator in the dialogue with the congregation, and knowing that Karen and I, if we chaired it, we would have a bias, and we didn't want to portray that bias to the rest of the congregation.
Yeah.
And we were partnering at the time with ARCH, I'm familiar with, a regional coalition for housing.
Oh yeah.
Which is a governmental agency, and they had and they brought in a person who was from outside, who was a trained facilitator and had no stake in the issue. Because of the issue, we didn't want to have, say, like the pastor do the facilitation,
right.
because even if he was a trained facilitator and knew how to do it properly, it could still be conceived, perceived by the members that there was some manipulation.
Did we have him for the community meeting?
That's right, it was for the community meeting, when we had an invitation to the community. That's when we had a professional.
I think that's great, and especially if they're paying for it. Because you have to pay, you know, a professional facilitator. Yeah.
Did ARCH pay for it, or was it a volunteer thing? I think he found a
volunteer.
It was somebody
from the city of Bellevue.
City of Bellevue who,
nice.
You know, was a trained facilitator.
That's great. That's
but,
great.
You know, this notion of, I kind of like the idea of the, even in smaller meetings, to set up a little bit more structure, because as co-chair, we kind of, you know, kind of running the show, and maybe making some changes in how that. Anyway, so I don't mean to send you off on that, but that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, you know, if it's a small group, and you know, a good chair can do that, but can facilitate things along. I find it very difficult to participate and facilitate meetings. So I took on that role when I was our council president, but I typically did not participate much. You know, I was so which was fine, you know, I to bring all the issues out and so forth, and to make sure, when you have a partnership outside of your church, I think it's just very important that people feel heard and that, you know, everyone has a voice and that you come to some kind of consensus in order to make it work, you know, because these relationships can be tricky. You know, we've been so blessed at Lake City so far, but we haven't gotten into the really tricky work yet either. I mean, we're in the honeymoon stage, I have to say. Yeah.
I'm blanking on the name of the author, but it's that mutual invitation method of having a conversation in a community where you have unequal partners.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we did that a lot at Seattle U when I was a student there. That everybody had a chance to talk.
Right.
So.
And it's going to become very interesting as we, right now, we don't have anybody from the community we're looking to serve at the table, homeless. And we've talked about how to do that, and that will be the tricky part where you have the people who don't feel... you know, are not really equal partners. It could easily be feel left out among all these educated, not that homeless people are not educated, many are very well educated, but you know, the population that we're serving in Lake City, 98% substance abuse issues and so forth, and so you walk into this, you know, room of people, it's very intimidating. So I'm not exactly sure how we're going to accomplish that yet, but that's a good example. How do you do that mutual invitation invite? When I have another project going on with Neighborhood House in Yesler Terrace, south of Seattle U. And so when we started, I have Break Bread Together here. We invited the staff from there who are very, who really represent ethnically and culturally and so forth, the people, the families that live in that Yesler Terrace housing development. And really amazing people, and we actually wanted to have the meeting at their place, the initial meeting, but it just worked out that we had it on our campus. That's the other thing about where do you have it. And so it was a great meeting. We did some education together about community-based research and so forth and talked about our goals and so forth, but I'm sure it was quite intimidating for this group, you know, looking at their behavior. Our first meeting where we came together and we had lunch and so forth, I said break bread together, on our turf. But in the end, I think it went pretty well. They relaxed and we had a whole day together to really hammer out what was it we wanted to do, what were each other's roles, and so forth. And we don't have a formal agreement with them, but we have many notes that we keep referring back to, and then that's partly my responsibility and the director of the Head Start to keep coming back to our original goals of what we wanted to accomplish and reminding each other what our roles were. But it's also been an evolving process. And then subsequent meetings have always been at their place because we just felt like, to have people, you know, I don't think of myself as an intimidating person, but our whole research team practically are doctorally prepared. So you come into our turf, it's intimidating. So forming a covenant, I think you need to decide, depending on what you're embarking on, whether or not you need a formal contract, you know, whether you need to involve an attorney. And I'm thinking for the housing the housing project, it's probably going to be quite formal, I'm guessing. Whereas our community-based research that we're doing with Yesler Terrace, as I said, we bring up meeting minutes where we agree to things. I say, this is what I heard everyone say. Is this correct? Give everybody a chance to comment on that, but yours sounds like it's going to be a formal agreement and that you'll bring to the congregation for approval and so forth.
Yeah, it's going to have to be that piece is very formal.
I mean, especially since you're using land and building and your, resources and...
You know, so the example you used earlier about your outreach team not necessarily needing to go to the congregation to get, or to the, even the council, just more of a FYI. And there are certain activities that a committee can do because that's under their, and the decisions they make are affecting that part of the church. What we're doing is definitely affecting the entire congregation and the entire
and the neighborhood. Yeah.
And so, because of that, the formality has to increase. Now, one of the things that comes up here, though, is since we've not gotten to that point, these partners are experienced in building low-cost housing. So they're going to bring the expertise of the agreement, right? Because they've made an agreement with St. Margaret's across the street, or they've made an agreement with the Lutheran Church in Renton. So I think that they're going to shape the contractual basis. But in terms of laying out, what I envision is that we lay out the responsibilities in this, and the responsibility as Holy Cross, as a faith community, is directing the vision. And that vision is, it's a complicated bringing together of the, going back to the core competencies, the groups within the church that have certain passions for certain elements of the mission of the church.
Yeah, the other thing I'm thinking is, I mean, they're in a little bit of a powerful role in a mm-hmm. sense. You know, when you look at the power differences, I could certainly see people in the congregation feeling like they come with the proposal and maybe feeling like they don't have enough say. So that's where I see a stumbling block for you. And I'm thinking what would be really helpful is to perhaps go to St. Margaret's and say, what do you wish you'd done differently?
Oh, that's a good question.
And what do you wish you'd included in that contract?
Or did
maybe they're saying, no, it's fine.
Right.
Or, you know, what's working great?
We've been kind of drafting behind them in terms of having some informal conversations with certain people, but not on an ongoing basis. That might be a good question to ask them is.
Because I think there is a fear of loss of control.
Sure. Right. And I think that's always a fear whenever we partner with anybody around an outreach is that we won't have control. So we're struggling to do something ourselves in our congregation, and we don't even maybe want other congregations sometimes to help. And when it would just make so much sense to leverage each other's strengths and so forth. This is definitely people will see spending this money and building a structure that's so permanent as a little threatening, but also risky in a great way. You know what I mean? You're really taking a leap to do something incredibly positive, make a huge difference. So focus on that, I guess.
Well, and it may involve tearing down the existing structures.
Oh, which are what?
The church.
Church.
The whole church?
And having a worship.
Oh my God.
Having a worship space in this housing building. Because we can have, you know, we've talked enough with the city of Bellevue to know that a multi-use building is acceptable. You know, the nonprofit agency can't build us a church. Right. But what we can do is get enough value back from the donation of the land to have money to have worship space.
So
we're talking about... Yeah. So
this is a pretty complicated...
So
that's only a possibility. It's possible we can keep our existing church, but certainly the parsonage, which is where the daycare center is, would probably go and two other little...
The sanctuary's going to come down?
It could.
Depends on what the architect...
Right.
Turn the architect loose and say, now...
What church is it?
Oh, I can't even imagine our church doing that, but I love that idea.
I don't mean to take your discussion off in a direction you want to go, but you just said something that's very exciting to me, and I want to share that with you.
What's that?
You made the statement that there is nobody from the audience that you're meeting at the table. And we're in the same situation, that we're, our working day in homelessness team is members of Holy Cross and representatives from ARCH. And the exciting idea is we also do Congregation for the Homeless. And in September, later this month, we're going to serve meals to Congregation for the Homeless at St. Margaret's.
Yeah.
And this is an exciting idea to go over and say to have a formal meeting or to have a discussion with them in there and say, is there anyone that would like to participate in our working in homelessness?
Yeah.
And then to step further, you said...
Because those guys are functioning at a good level when they're there. Because they have to be sober.
That's right. They're the ones that have recognized what, you know, their program is to identify, and many of them know where what brought them to homelessness. And then they've lived in homelessness. So the other issue that you mentioned, and then I'll stop, is you said, then go to their place. And one of the ideas is okay, from now on our monthly meeting will be where you are.
Well, with the neighborhood house, I feel like it was incredibly important because, as I said, there was I'm sure it's somewhat of a perceived power difference. And I think over time as they've gotten to know us, that we're not very scary, even though we're these, you know, PhDers and all that. But, and we've come to just so appreciate the work that they do, and we've had a lot of sharing back and forth, and we get very excited at these meetings with, like, oh, this is so great, and that's a kind of another topic I wasn't going to bring up. So it depends. I mean, you have to think about those things as you're reaching out to people and think about what is the best way to sort of level, you know, the playing field and so forth. I also think that top leadership should be very visible to the partner, you know, if you're gonna. And one of the things that we did in the spring, this was so cool, was Father Steve Sundorf, who's the president of our university, went for lunch at God's Little Acre, which is a drop-off center for homeless men and women to have a place to store their belongings during the day, because that's as you see people going around with everything that they own, it's very difficult, you know, so they can go maybe and off and look for a job or whatever. And so he came to lunch, and he's just a real personable guy, but he always wears his collar, so he's obviously, you know, in the ministry, because he feels it's important. The other priests don't. He says, I feel like as the president, I need to. But he's just such a down-to-earth guy. And it really said a lot to the community. And there were many homeless people there for lunch. Word got out. They don't always serve lunch. And so word got out that we were going to have lunch that day. And we had a whole bunch of people come. And so we had some of our nursing students. We had this whole very eclectic group, informal meeting, where we broke bread together. And it was really kind of fun. And so it was very, for Jonathan and Melanie, the co-pastors at the Mennonite Church, and other leaders from the community in Lake City, to see that commitment by our university, not just at the professor level, I think was a very powerful statement. So it sounds like your pastor is very on board with this. Yeah. I mean, we have to be.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. He does end up having to play a little bit of a balancing role because of other mission areas of the church.
Yeah.
Ours is obviously the one that's going forward with some of the largest changes to the structure of the church.
Yeah.
And what it means to be church.
I'm going to have to, maybe we should have our outreach talk with you, because we have a bunch of land around our church, and we've talked about doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are we doing with this?
Yeah.
You know, but having you to, there's another example I wanted to bring up. Well, anyway, it's on here, and that reminded me of what you said about having worship, you know, integrated into the housing. which I think is a really cool idea. Well, anyway, to my exemplar, I've talked a little bit about it, the Seattle Mennonite Church. And this is the what they have on their website. What I love about them, I was looking at our website, and then which was kind of dismally disappointing to me, because when I looked at the Mennonite website, they have their outreach ministries clearly listed of what they're doing and the updates and so forth. So anybody can look at that. And I want to talk with Melanie more and more about, you know, maybe as this gets going, to have either a separate website, I think, is quite often very good in community outreach work and academia. Quite often we like to have a website just for that outreach. So if you have different community partners, mm-hmm. they're contributing to that. So everybody kind of knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. It's nice to be as transparent as possible, to have meeting minutes up. So there's other ways that you can communicate to the community, you know, what you're doing, particularly if you have people that are nervous about what you're doing. And I think homeless is always makes everybody in the neighborhood nervous. But just to give you, so that you get a background of what the Mennonites say. So the last statement: to that end, Seattle Mennonite Church seeks to partner with local residents, businesses, and agencies in generating a grassroots, person-centered effort to companion people who are experiencing homelessness.
Wow,
it's beautiful.
It is beautiful, and you know, they really walk the talk, is from what is my experience, and so I've been very, very impressed. And so I like the way this was up there, and then underneath that is all the ministries that they're doing in order to meet that. What they did very early on, a couple of years ago, was form a Lake City Task Force on Homelessness. So it's part of that Chamber of Commerce Development Council. So there's this sort of umbrella task force that was formed, I'm thinking Melanie and Jonathan came there in 2007, do you know? And it's been a few years now. And I think this was one of the things that they were instrumental in getting going. And from that, so they really involved the business leaders from the get-go in what they were doing. And realizing
this was really unusual in the project. I'm a federal official. I oversee a lot of these. I try to broker these deals. And this was just a unique aspect that they did, that to engage the local commerce and businesses. It was kind of a neighborhood center. I was just so impressed with what they did.
I know. I went back to my church.
I've seen a lot of associations with churches and local agencies making those partnerships happen, but for a church to be so aggressive about, and just impressed is wrong word, but you know, getting out into the community, engaging local businesses, and they did on the backs, because homeless people were perceived to be the problem in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. so the businesses were readily engaged, and the credibility of the church just to...
That's my understanding too. They were like, these people are sleeping on our doorsteps, and we need to do something about it. So there was some, impetus for change there. Even though but it's also scary at the same time. I think, of course.
But Lake City's had various churches have done tent city,
right?
And
right.
So some of that, you know, that reaction to people when you have tent city in your neighborhood. Sometimes the neighbors around the churches aren't real happy about that.
Also that.
And they've also had that really good food bank in Lake City that's supported by lots of churches for a really long time.
Yeah.
I don't know if that homelessness, if that's part of that or not.
Well, there's certainly been things that have been going on for quite a while there. And so this is not totally new to this neighborhood. But they've done a really lovely job. I say that they are the secret weapon for that church, because Melanie has a master's in social work, so I think she's got that skill set to really, you know, bring in the partners and so forth, and you know, bring everybody to the table and finesse that. So she has brought in those people that were already working on things, and I have a laundry list of some of the partners here that have been ongoing. You're right. There's been some really good work there, because it's an area that really needs it.
But it's that permanent supportive housing that would make a huge difference.
Yes.
That would be.
And they just built, as a result, I think, well, of a lot of people's work, the McDermott Place, and in the which is housing, and some of it has been designated just for veterans, and it's named after our representative Jim McDermott, and so forth. We really wanted to push for that. And then there's the Rhoda Claire Clinic, which was a free clinic, which was going on in the neighborhood. Part of the deal was then that would have space in the bottom, and mental health services set up there, and I'm trying blocking on the name of the agency that moved in. So capitalizing on those partnerships that were already going. And I think having this Chamber of Commerce task force involved has really helped to, you know, move that into place. So the Seattle Mennonite Church, with other churches, I guess, started also having this place where you can leave your belongings in the church, and then bought a couple of houses adjacent, and one of them's called God's Little Acre. And so in there, the people are able to cook a meal. They can leave some food there. They have, and then they have little locker areas where they can store their belongings and leave all day. And they call it God's Little Acre. And what's kind of fun is that my partner in all this, Lauren Lawson, had a group of students from community health in this area. And as they were doing their walkabout for their windshield survey, they stumbled upon God's Little Acre. And about 2 years ago, so we started forming this relationship where we placed students there. And of course, being the community partner kind of people that they are, and Melanie and Jonathan just welcomed them immediately and formed this partnership with Lauren. And she's there at least 3/4 a year, so we have this presence there. So we already had a presence with them, and so I was not involved at that point. But I was going to say, they also do weekly meals with other churches. And I think those are based at, is the Presbyterian Church? No, I can't remember. Permanent supportive housing. So they have in these houses, they do try and place people.
They're tearing those down, though, right? Have they started building it?
Yes, that's another partnership that sprung up. They're going to tear them down and build more housing with, and I think I've got it on the next slide.
Community psychiatric clinic.
Yeah, community psychiatric clinic. And that's with, I'm trying to think of the
guy. It was my small hand in that deal, was to try to broker that relationship.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, so they're selling those off, and the deal is that they'll have room for God's a place for people to continue dropping their belongings off, but also where we can put people into, you know, as they get into jobs and so forth, you know, get them in the permanent housing. And I'm trying to think of what else is going to be in there. Food, but there's the deal. You probably know more than I do about it.
Those same ministries that they have just sort of repackaged, because they've got land, that's the big asset that most churches bring to this deal. They have this availability of land and as well, in a relatively, well, in the city area, it's hard to get.
Yes, so that's going to be fantastic, you know. And anyway, and then for us, it's planning for the medical respite program. So these are all the various partners. So it's the community psychiatric clinic.
It's involved a lot since I saw it last.
Yeah, and Lutheran Compass Center is involved. So there's many, and I'm sure I don't have them on here, that have been sort of brought together. So this is an example of, you've got all these, it's not really starting at the ground level, because you've got all these efforts, as we're saying, that are doing things, but bringing them together to really serve the people in this neighborhood. And I think because the leadership with this is so focused on the issue and not territorial, it has really worked well. So I think that's the other lesson in all this, is that if you want to do this work, you can't be territorial about who does what. You just have to say, what's best for the people that we're serving? And King County Public Health is somewhat involved as well. So I think it's the Presbyterian Church that hosts the hunger intervention program, is that correct? Anyway, and that's a program that started in downtown Seattle and has really grown to provide meals and so forth. And the kitchen that they have in downtown also teaches, it's kind of a community kitchen where people learn how to cook. And they've got a nutritionist, and some of our nursing students are involved in that as well. So anyway, so really leveraging all these services together. And so our piece, the way where we came along, is based on her assessments with students and with other people in the, you know, addressing this issue. There was a lot of anecdotal evidence about people getting discharged from the hospital that are homeless. And there's a big article in the paper about a year ago in the Seattle Times about a guy who was discharged and was living in his car and died in his car, was found dead in his car. And we had a guy in Lake City some months ago that, I want to say about 4 or 5 months ago, that I think had he had a safe place to go where his wounds could have been cared for and he received his medications regularly and so forth, that, you know, probably wouldn't have died, and he had died as well. So this, both the students that we had out there and Lauren, who knew him much better than me, were just extremely upset about this. So anecdotal evidence of what we're seeing, we're feeling like there's a real need for respite care. And our students have also done a needs assessment. So that led to us doing a grant proposal. I have to say, it was one of the easier grant proposals I've done, because we knew that the Senegals that own Costco really had a vested, they love our School of Nursing, they've given us money in the past, but they said, we want you to do something about homelessness. We just feel really strongly about this. And so then I was pulled in and said, you know, please write a grant with Lauren, who's master's prepared, so didn't really have those skills, and we were a good match. And when I say it was the easiest grant, and I had to write a grant, but I knew it just had to be good enough to for our higher ups in our college and the Senegals to go forward. And so, they very generously gave us $350,000 for this project. It's just amazing. They're incredibly generous people. So at that point we formed a community. One of the first things we did then was to form another sort of subset community advisory board specific to this project. So we've got some of the same members that are on the Chamber of Commerce board. Lauren is on that, for example. We have a physician who volunteers at the Rota Care Clinic, who's on our board, who is super passionate about people, you know, not just homeless, but people at a certain income level, low income level, who are unable to get health care. A lot of those people use his clinic. And he's really a neat guy. And we have people from the mental health clinic and Swedish and so forth involved in this community advisory board. And that's the one where I've sort of sat back and let Melanie be the facilitator as we move forward. So we're spending some of our time initially educating ourselves, getting to know each other, as I said, breaking bread. But we had a graduate student, for example, this last year, do a study on we have two respite care centers in Seattle, one for men and a small one for women, and those are actually getting merged into a new one. Oh my gosh, is that the end? Shoot.
Lunch goes a while, you can keep going.
Okay, if you have to leave, feel free to leave. I don't want to. So, what was I going to say? So we had our student do a study on what were the most common diagnoses and things that were being treated at Seattle Respite, because we needed to gear up for what are we going to see? And skin stuff was by far the biggest. Of course, almost everybody has substance abuse issues, but pain, post-surgical wound care and so forth. But feet problem, people who are homeless, feet and skin problems were by far the biggest ones. There were some other kind of chronic medical issues going on with people, but having that skin expertise, because we kind of wanted to know what can we expect. And so that was extremely helpful. And then we are going to have a speaker come and talk to us about community-based, you know, research and participatory kind of action. What can you expect from this process of working together? Because I'm doing this as a research project, and with Lauren, part of it. So just very quickly, we're going to be looking at, you know, the outcomes down the road. I'm going to talk about that a little bit on Friday, about how do you measure outcomes. But we're going to look at, you know, outcomes in terms of, we hope, readmission to hospital. So from the hospital side, you know, the utilization of the emergency department and readmission is a real problem. And so for the respite care center downtown, they're asking the hospitals to each pony up about $200,000 each to pay for it, I think, a year. But it's actually, for the hospitals, you know, a pretty good deal.
Right, because they don't want people coming back
in the New York.
No.
Especially,
yeah. It's very, yeah, well, that's a very ineffective. You know, emergency departments aren't primary care facilities. And so we're going to be looking at some of those sorts of things and you know, what happens with these guys, hopefully following them. We're doing an initial assessment of the guys in the community. I say guys because it's mostly homeless guys, with our graduate students, and we went through internal review board at Seattle University in order to do that. We'll be doing informed consent. And we'll be using some of the homeless guys to help facilitate that. So they'll be going out with the graduate students to help do the interviews, to for us to get a handle on, you know, what do they want to see in respite care. They have to, would you be willing to go? Because quite often, you know, people have had very bad experiences in some of these overnight shelters. So, you know, what do you want to see? Trying to get a grasp on that. And the students are very excited to do this. And so it's a learning experience for them, and then I help them process that data on my end. But some of the questions, what's difficult as a researcher for community-based research, is it comes from the process of working together with this board. And so we tell them, this is what we're thinking. And it's sort of hard for me to lose control sometimes a little bit of the research project. But if it's going to be community-based, it has to come from the community. So that's a, I'm always letting, that's the piece that, I don't find it hard to let go of everything else, but that, as a researcher, I find that kind of hard to let go, and I always have to remind myself. And then participatory action is where you actually, what we hope in the end is that we have some effect on maybe not so much legislation, but we hope that the hospital partner in that area, Northwest Hospital, will agree to be a partner and treat. If we can show them that it will actually save them money in the long run, and perhaps we can have an effect on policy, you know, in Lake City and also in the hospital level. So that's what you, that's what you're going for when you do this kind of process, is that you not only meet the needs of the community, but that you somehow make an impact on policy decisions as well. Kind of rushing through that last little part, darn it. But anyway, that's a community-based approach. But I don't want to take up more time because it's lunchtime. Any other comments? I'm so glad you came, since you're tangentially involved. And it's I can tell you, this has been the most gratifying community project I've ever been involved in so far. We might be in the honeymoon phase, but okay. Yeah, thank you so much for coming. Okay. I think that was it. That was the last.